From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Lamont Young is regarded as one of modern music's most influential composers, but there's a good chance you've never heard his work. Young isn't interested in the commercial part of making music, and so he keeps tight control over recordings and performances. Still, you can hear his influence in the work of Philip Glass, or the Velvet Underground, or Yoko Ono. He's seen as the patriarch of minimalism, and his music is conceptual and epic, and it takes in all kinds of ideas and theories and methods, among them the cosmology of Mormonism, which he learned growing up in Utah and Idaho. The music scholar Jeremy Grimshaw has written a book about Young. It's the first to examine his life and work in detail. Today in the program, Grimshaw will join us to talk about Lamont Young, one of music's most enigmatic and fascinating figures. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So there's a risk when you try and chronicle the life of a musical genius. They tend to be eccentric or elusive or controlling or all three. The music scholar Jeremy Grimshaw knew what he was getting into when he decided to write a book that explores the life and music of Lamont Young. Young is regarded as one of modern music's most influential composers. He's thought of as the patriarch of the minimalist movement. His music is conceptual and epic and takes in all kinds of ideas and theories, among them the cosmology of Mormonism that he learned growing up in Idaho and Utah. Grimshaw has written a book. It's called Draw a Straight Line and Follow It, The Music and Mysticism of Lamont Young. And today in the program, he's joining us to talk about it. Jeremy Grimshaw is an assistant professor at Brigham Young University's School of Music. He's also founding director of BYU's Balinese Ensemble, and he's written another book. It's called The Island of Bali is Littered with Prayers. It chronicles his experience learning music in Bali and bringing it to Utah. Jeremy Grimshaw, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug. It's a pleasure.
All right, let me ask you this. When did you first hear a piece of music by Lamont Young? Do you remember?
Well, I think it was in grad school. I first heard about him.
You'd heard about him before you heard the music.
But, yeah, but it was hard to find his music. You find stories about him before you find the stuff that the stories are about.
Huh.
And when I started grad school, I was interested in minimalism. I was a percussionist as an undergrad, and a lot of the minimalist composers do percussion works. And somebody turned me on to – a friend of mine turned me on to Lamont Young, and they said, well, you might be interested in this guy because he's from the West. From Idaho and Utah, and if you like the stuff that you're into now, wait till you hear some of his stuff.
Right.
So I think the first piece that I heard was probably the Well-Tuned Piano, which is probably his best known work. You know, it's one of the few pieces that you can find occasionally.
Yeah. Or play.
Right. Well, he's the only one that's ever played it publicly.
Wow.
One other person has studied it with him, but they've never performed it for anybody else besides him.
Well, I have to say it makes it a little complicated too, because he keeps a tight control over the copyright, the performance. And so I'm not even sure what we can play today. We'll talk about this and sort of figure out as we go. But I guess it reflects how much control he likes over his music. But also that he doesn't really care that much about the commercial aspect of it, it seems.
Well, I mean, he's – one of the most interesting things about him, and one of the things that has made him even more interesting, is that early on in his career, he sort of created a situation for himself where he didn't have to care about those things.
Yeah.
Eventually, he put out his own recordings, so he didn't have to worry about record labels. He does his own publishing to the extent that he publishes
sure.
his pieces. So he doesn't have to worry about music publishers. He has his own venue, so he doesn't really have to worry about venues. And so that means that as an artist, he can do whatever he wants. And he's also enjoyed a level of patronage from wealthy philanthropists that have supported his work that's pretty rare. Mm. And so it's sort of the two sides of the coin are that, you know, he's able to do whatever he wants as an artist and do really amazing, innovative things. But on the other hand, he doesn't leave the same kind of footprint in the music world that others would, especially other people with the kind of influence that he's had.
So what made you want to write about him?
Well, I mean, part of it was the music and part of it was the story. I mean, he's such an interesting figure, and his story is so interesting. I mean, the more I got into reading about his background and listening to his music, it was such a great story. I mean, the way that he remembers these very poignant moments from his childhood and sort of weaves that into the way he writes music. Mm. It just all sort of came together in this amazing way, and I just kind of got absorbed into it.
What did Lamont Young make of you at first when you approached him? I mean, here's a guy from Brigham Young University. He has – Mormonism is a powerful influence in the way he thought about music early on, probably mm-hmm. still in the way it weaves its way, these philosophical ideas through his music. I expect he figured you were a Mormon, which you are, from mm-hmm. Brigham Young University when you encountered him. I mean, was he suspicious? Was he welcoming? What was it like when you first encountered
well,
him?
Well, when I first I mean, I was in grad school and I was writing a term paper. So, I mean, he really probably shouldn't have fielded the call. At the time I wasn't from BYU. And I was never a student at BYU either. But I called him up and I...
So you didn't telegraph the fact, hello, I'm a Mormon.
Well, actually, I sort of did. Okay. And the weird thing was that was sort of my foot in the door initially because I called him up and a woman answered. It turned out to be his collaborator and partner, Marion Zazila.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I'm interested in Lamont's music and sort of how it relates to his background, especially coming from the West and coming from a Mormon background. And she said, well, what do you know about Mormonism? I said, well, actually, I'm Mormon. And mm-hmm. she said, oh, that makes things interesting. Let me get him on the line.
Wow.
And that was my foot in the door.
That was your way in.
And I think part of it, he told me at the time that he was glad to have somebody that could sort of navigate those two worlds.
Yeah.
His family could never really understand what he did.
Of course.
I mean, you can't imagine like a greater cultural distance between like his salt of the earth parents.
Orthodox and, Mormon parents.
Absolutely.
In many ways. Yeah.
And I mean, imagine that. And then in 1960, he's in New York hanging out with Yoko Ono. Yeah. I mean.
Or just look at a picture of him now. I mean, with the beard and the, you know, I mean. They don't seem to match.
Yeah. Well, and so initially he said, well, maybe one of the things that you can do, because he doesn't do a lot of interviews.
All right.
And he gets a fair amount of requests for them.
Sure.
But he said, you know, maybe that you can be sort of a liaison somehow and sort of try to convey to my family what it is that I do and convey to them that it's of some value and sort of be the go-between, which was kind of a weird situation to be in. But that was our relationship at the beginning. Now, as the book progressed, his attitude towards his Mormon background kind of changed.
Yeah.
I think partly because the public perception of Mormonism, especially in downtown New York, kind of changed because
Was this during the Proposition 8 thing?
Well, I mean, before that, when I first spoke to him in 2001, I think, and before that, he would talk about Mormonism quite openly in interviews, and I think he saw that as sort of one of many interesting facets to his very enigmatic sort of personality.
Yeah.
I mean, there aren't that many ways to really. Be unique, in downtown New York,
right?
In the downtown art scene, and so that was part of his persona, was the kid that grew up Mormon in rural Idaho.
States, yeah. But it seems like there are two parts of Mormonism for Lamont Young. One is the and we'll talk about this as we go along because the influence of Mormonism on his music is really interesting. You write about it, but there's that one part of Mormonism which is funky cosmic doctrine of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
That appealed to him.
Mm-hmm.
But the sort of more button-down, middle-class, suburban, family values kind of mainstream Mormonism view of today is the thing that is not so appealing to this guy. Is that
well,
right?
And I think that was never part of his Mormon experience either.
Sure.
You know, because he's growing up in a pretty isolated – I mean, it's near – it's near Salt Lake, but
but it's a cabin where he was born.
Yeah, I mean literally.
Yeah,
and it's still there in Bern. But yeah, I think the sort of public perception of like the Osmond image of Mormonism was never his experience of Mormonism necessarily. And so those are the one of the things that I talk about in the or I speculate about in the book is that he's always talking about these moments in his childhood where he hears a sound, the wind whistling across the cracks between the logs in the log cabin, and or the hum of the step down transformer by his grandfather's Conoco station, or the crickets in the field, and he's always having these sonic kind of epiphanies. And I have to think that he also had some cosmic epiphanies that sort of went along with those. And those are the sorts of things.
What do you mean, like spiritual experiences?
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Or just not necessarily, I don't know.
You Who
know,
knows?
Spiritual
yeah.
experiences or just moments of wonder
yeah.
tied into those kind of sonic epiphanies that I think had to have been influenced by the way that he would have that people would have talked over the pulpit and in Sunday school classes about heaven and the relationship between matter and spirit and the cosmos, that that aspect of Mormonism that really isn't regular pulpit speak in a typical congregation today.
Yeah. Is there something in a piece of music that we can play where you hear now that drone of crickets from Idaho, or that hum from the transformer at the gas station in his grandfather's place? Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something we can play that's not literally or directly that is, but is there something that we can play that gives us some sense of that? This is putting you on the spot a little
sure,
bit,
sure.
But is there something that you hear that can also give us, as we head into a break, a taste of what we're talking about, what we're talking about, the music of
Sure. Well, one of his most important pieces is the well-tuned piano.
Yeah.
This epic 6.5-hour piece for a piano that's tuned to a very unusual tuning.
Right.
And one of the things that he does in the well-tuned piano is he builds up these moments of – he calls them cloud sections, where he just plays lots of notes in rapid configurations. And he's actually trying to line up the keystrokes with like the acoustical beating of the strings,
right?
And so it just makes this sort of roar where all the sounds blend together, and all these other sounds result from them. I don't know if you have a cloud section.
We're putting the people in the control room kind of on the spot here. So direct us here, because there's that. Is there a section in this that we can play, or maybe during a break, let's work through it and find that? Because I think
sure.
really interesting about, because I want people to be able to hear it. So we'll do that at a break. That makes
sure.
that makes most sense. Let me ask you this though before we head into it. And you write about this. You're upfront about this in the book. Like in the acknowledgments, you say you regard Lamont Young as a friend, but it was conflicted too, because as it evolved, it kind of broke down this relationship. He stopped liking maybe what you were pursuing in some ways, and kind of disintegrated in some ways. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's hard to say what he thinks of me now. I ultimately had to proceed. I considered myself very, very lucky to have his support through most of this project. And it was really difficult to try to keep things friendly with him, but also bring the project to fruition, yeah. not just because I wanted to get a book out, but because, you know, I feel really strongly about his music, that there's really something amazing in it that people need to hear.
Yeah.
And he's just never, because of the situation that he's created for himself, it's sometimes self-defeating in terms of like creating an audience for his music. And so I had to decide, well, do I want to you know, acquiesce to all of the sort of editorial things that he wants me to do, maybe at the expense of scholarship?
Sure.
Or do I go forward with this project, which I think ultimately, you know, serves his music well and serves his art well, even if it means straining the personal relationship.
Yeah. There's this great story you tell of you actually stayed with Lamont Young and his partner there in their apartment, this incredible space, which seems really interesting. But you tell the story of them asking you at some point to do the laundry. And you talk about it being this catch-22 where you say, on one hand, you know, should I do this? Should I do their laundry? Am I crossing some sort of boundary here? On one hand, the personal connection is great. I'm here in his apartment and he's saying, hey, throw the whites in or whatever, you know, whatever it is. But then you say, but will I lose all objectivity if I do this?
Yeah. Well, it was tricky, but I mean, as a musicologist, I'm there doing archival work.
Yeah.
Right? That's what musicologists do.
Yeah.
We go through and we look at letters between so-and-so and Lamont, and we make chronologies and we examine scores and things like that. But I'm also there kind of as an ethnomusicologist, and ethnomusicology sort of borrows like fieldwork practices from anthropology. So we think a lot about our relationship with our collaborators or informants. And we do a lot of sort of methodological hand-wringing about that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so I'm there, you know, holding these letters that are just fantastic between Lamont and all of these other really important people. And he asked me to do, you know, put in a load of laundry. And, it was this kind of crisis. But then I thought, you know what? I'm in his house. I'm already under his roof. It's already a pretty complex situation. I think I'm already past that threshold. So, yeah, I did the laundry.
Jeremy Grimshaw is with us. His book, Draw a Straight Line and Follow It, The Music and Mysticism of Lamont Young. We're going to take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about one of American music's most enigmatic and fascinating characters, Lamont Young. He was born and raised a Mormon in rural Utah and Idaho, became a pioneer of the minimalist movement. His work influenced Philip Glass, Yoko Ono, the Velvet Underground. The rock producer Brian Eno called Young the daddy of us all. BYU music professor Jeremy Grimshaw has written a book that explores Lamont Young's life and music, and he's joining us today to talk about it. The book is called Draw a Straight Line and Follow It, The Music and Mysticism of Lamont Young. So, Jeremy Grimshaw, we talked about some music, and there's a section that in the well-tuned piano that I want you to kind of work us through. Set this up for us, if you would.
Okay, so the well-tuned piano is this piece that he actually began experimenting with in 1964, and he started playing around with the tuning of the piano. And the most striking thing about – I mean, to somebody that's never heard it before, the most striking thing about the well-tuned piano is just the sound of the instrument, because, you know, there are all of these notes sort of hidden in the cracks between the keys on a regular piano.
Yeah.
And he uses a bunch of those notes. And they're kind of jarring the first time you hear them. But another interesting aspect of this piece is that he really tries to just cover as much sort of cosmic and musical terrain as he can. And he does it by huge contrasts between fast sections and slow sections and high and low. And there's a section of the piece called the Magic Harmonic Rainforest Chord. And all of the sections have these very elaborate names.
Right.
There are these three sections that are separated by a few minutes. And in the first one, he plays this theme in what he calls the deep pool. And the deep pool seems to refer to this low E flat. Maybe we can play that.
Yeah.
So you kind of hear that growl of that low E flat at the bottom there.
Yeah.
So a few minutes later, he comes back to that same kind of material, but he plays it in what he calls the deeper pool. And he goes to a lower E flat. And this would be an E flat closest to like the lowest E flat on a regular piano.
Right. So we're getting deeper?
Yeah, it's getting lower and lower. In the pool.
Right.
Here it is. Now, on a regular piano, you don't get much lower than that. But when he created the well-tuned piano, eventually he was able to perform it on this customized instrument. That has an extended lower range. There's an old piano company named Busendorfer that makes these pianos with extra notes on the bottom.
Wow.
And so the final time he brings back this theme, he brings it back in what's called the deepest pool. And it uses this low, low E flat that doesn't exist on most pianos. And in the tuning system that he's using, it's actually lower than what we're supposed to be able to hear. Our hearing usually cuts out at about 20 hertz on the low end.
Wow.
Or 20 up and down waves, you know, in a second.
Yeah.
And this one is about 18.6 hertz. It's really low and growly.
Okay, so this is that part.
The deepest pool.
The deepest pool.
Part of the reason that's so striking is because all of the notes on the piano, in the way that he tunes them, they have this, and not to get into the acoustics too much, but they have this rational harmonic relationship with each other. They resonate together in a certain way so that he kind of preps our ears to hear this really low sound that we're kind of not supposed to be able to hear.
Do you see a kind of trajectory of his work? I mean, this was... When did he write this particular piece?
Well, even saying writing the
piece. That's it. That's right. I mean, that's one thing you learned about him is it's never finished.
Right, right. That's part of the reason that it was difficult to finish the book, too, because...
He said, no, I'm not done with that.
Exactly.
So but when did he start thinking about this piece, maybe?
In 1964.
Yeah.
And he played around with it and developed it. In the 1980s, he gave several performances of it.
Right. This music is from one of those.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the last time that he's – or the most recent, I suppose he could pull it up again. But the most recent performance was in 1987.
Wow.
So if you really want to sort of stamp a date on the piece, it's 1964 to 1987.
You say in the book that in the early music that he in some ways he didn't think of music as a narrative necessarily, or even as a way of expressing sentiment or emotion, that it was about structure. Is that right?
Well, in a certain way. I mean, the music that he was studying, the music that a lot of composition students would have been studying when he's studying composition, was what we call serialism.
Yeah.
And it was all about it wasn't all about structure, but it used very rigorous methods to create musical structures and a kind of musical order and logic. And he was fascinated by that. But even in the early pieces, he would hear a chord that's, you know, produced by these very careful, methodic compositional procedures. Mm. But he's still, I mean, you can hear him kind of swimming around in this chord. That's why he plays them for so long,
yeah.
Right? He takes serialism and just stretches it. Later he describes it as getting inside the sound.
Yeah. He said that truly objective music, that is music as the object anyway, is the domain of the real world of sound, not a deeper level of abstract relationships.
Yeah, I think – and I think that ties into his sort of autobiographical obsessions, because you can try to be an objective listener and just listen to acoustics. But ultimately, that's going to be part of your overall kind of sonic experience. And so even as he's dealing with pretty esoteric compositional methods and getting into rational tuning that – you know, involves a lot of scary-looking math to the layperson.
Yeah.
It's still deeply, deeply personal for him, and he's still constantly tying that into memories of his childhood and his background and this the notion of the West and space and long sustained.
So it's always there. That's always there. That sense of it. It's never just this dispassionate piece of math. It's always something deeply personal for him.
Yeah, it's always. I mean, because it's really easy to when you get into the acoustics of the kind of music that he ends up doing. It's really easy to kind of nerd out on the numbers.
Right.
And that in and of itself can be pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But eventually, you kind of just have to settle in and use your ears, you know, put your ears before your brain, I guess.
Well, you say that over time he sort of began to see himself as a kind of music mystic. So I wanted you to talk about what that means, because in some ways he saw music as conveying these kind of eternal or spiritual truths, or like this eternal secret in some ways, which I think to me brings up the idea of Mormonism, which we'll get to, of course.
But. Well, that was one of the first things that made me interested in that aspect of his background. I'd be reading these interviews where he'd be talking about almost in a kind – I mean, you think of it as sort of a psychedelic speak or something,
right.
Countercultural kind of rhetoric.
Yeah.
And someone – in one interview, someone said, so it seems like your music is really sort of obsessed with eternity and infinity and things like that. And Lamont says, "Well, I'm interested in very basic questions of existence, like where are we from, and why are we here, and where are we going?" And those seem like
these are the basic Mormon questions.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Those, and they seem like totally innocuous to anybody who doesn't know that sort of discourse.
Yeah.
But I mean, I tell that story to Mormons, and they immediately know where he got it.
I wonder. I wanted to ask you about when it was that you talk about how his family fostered this enthusiasm for musical recreation.
Mm-hmm.
And then you write about how he was really taken by jazz early on, and that blues became this obsession for him as well.
Oh, yeah.
So what was it? It was just this adding one thing onto another thing onto another thing. And then you say something really compelling in the book where you say – that there was this time when he was obsessed with the color blue. And so I'm trying to put all of these things together, this kind of obsession with these things that he keeps working them out. Does that explain a little bit of who Lamont Young
Well, I mean, is? He does. Anytime he latches onto an idea, he just completely embraces it and exhausts it, you might say. He does that with composers or styles of music that he's interested in. You know, he discovers the serialist composers and he just jumps into it and writes a bunch of pieces based on their ideas, and especially the composer Anton Webern. And then he tries to out Webern Webern.
Yeah.
And then he discovers John Cage and he enters into a correspondence with John Cage, and then he tries to out Cage Cage. And that and he's always doing that until he gets to Indian music. And then he discovers this guru, Pandit Pran Nath,
right.
Who's this kind of esoteric North Indian vocalist. And that's kind of where he finds the one sort of model that he can't outdo.
Huh.
And is
he troubled by that, or does he feel content finally?
Well, he and his partner Marion, they literally become disciples of Pran Nath. And they're very devoted to him, even to this day. To the point where when they give concerts, you know, there's a shrine off in the corner.
Wow.
With incense and a photo of Pran Nath and Pran Nath's teacher and his teacher and so on. And that's really the first time that he's sort of – that he remains deferential to a musical figure that that becomes an obsession for him. And he learns North Indian music from Pran Nath, but he still adapts it. He still kind of changes it, especially after Pran Nath dies in 1996. He sees himself as carrying as carrying the torch, but he also kind of mixes it with the sorts of things that he was doing as an American, you know, experimental minimalist composer.
I want to ask about where Mormonism fits then as we go along. It seems like it was kind of the basis. Like it was a base anyway. I mean, he told you that his sort of later spiritual developments were kind of built on a Mormon foundation.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he started. And then and things sort of built from there.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that it was particular aspects of Mormonism
sure.
that stuck with him.
Yeah.
I think that might be a fair way to put it, that he might not even dispute at this point, even though he's expressed some concern about how I talk about his Mormon background. But I think the thing that it gets to is in Mormonism, there's this notion that there's a kind of contiguity. There's this special connection between the world that we see and the world that we don't see. Mm-hmm. Mormon scripture describes it this way, that spirit is just a more refined kind of matter. So that there's this special connection between the physical world and the spiritual world. And that sort of liminal, that kind of crossing that boundary is always what he's been interested in musically. I mean, that's what transcendence is, right? Where you're able to cross or at least peek through that boundary between the physical and the metaphysical. And that's something that he carried with him. I think that desire for a kind of transcendence or a desire to see those worlds as connected. And I think that sticks with him from that particular aspect of Mormonism, and he carries it through in maybe unexpected ways,
yeah.
especially like in the 60s. He becomes entrenched in psychedelic culture, and you might say that he's trying to do with acoustics and psychoacoustics what some of the psychedelics are trying to do with, you know, biochemistry, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of finding a physical, you know, finding a way to manipulate the physical world in order to allow you to peek into the spiritual world.
Well, you say he believed that every prophet from Buddha to Muhammad to Joseph Smith articulated a different facet of the same divinity.
Mm-hmm. Different facet of the same jewel. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was the remarkable thing is that when he – when I don't know what he would say now, but when I, you know, when I first talked to him about Mormonism – he accepted the claims of Mormonism, the prophetic claims of Joseph Smith, in a pretty unproblematic way,
wow.
in a pretty straightforward way. It was just not in an exclusive way.
Sure. So that made sense to him. But, yeah. but the Muhammad story also made sense to him. The Buddha story made sense to him.
Sure. And that also, you know, laid ample precedent for the sort of inspiration and kind of I don't know if he would be comfortable with the word revelation, but the kind of sort of divine inspiration that he tried to seek as a composer.
It's so funny because you talk about how it's in the when he goes to school. I mean, he ends up in Southern California with his family, and then he goes to L.A., the L.A. The College of L.A. What is it?
City College.
The City College, of L.A. And that's where he starts to distance himself a little bit, you say, from mm-hmm. – from his kind of rural roots.
And I think part of that is where the cultural distance starts to open up between him and his family, because he's hanging out with – there are these really remarkable jazz musicians.
Yeah.
I mean, and he's gigging with these guys that become legendary. I mean, he beats out Eric Dolphy in a saxophone chair audition for the dance band. And Eric Dolphy, of course, becomes this legendary saxophonist in his own right and a sideman to John Coltrane. And so he's gigging at clubs and playing with Ornette Coleman and Billy Higgins. I mean, really monster players at a really young age. And so that puts him in different social circles, and that probably puts him in circles where, you know, that aren't observant exactly of Mormon dietary restrictions and things like that. So for his family, I think it was hard to separate his movement, his absorption with jazz and blues from his distancing himself from religious orthodoxy.
There's this really amazing story that you write about that I wanted to talk about. It's this phone call that he makes to his father in 2003. And his father was at the time living in California. And Lamont calls him, his father, Dennis Young, to mm-hmm. wish him a happy Father's Day. And as you write about it in the book, I mean, they had been separated, of course, for decades. This family, this very orthodox, very sort of traditionally Mormon family, could not understand the avant-garde path that he had chosen. His music, they didn't get his music. They didn't understand why he left, you know, sort of regular, you know, Mormonism. But it's such a lovely moment, and you were there for it, which yeah. is really cool. And I have to say that, and it gives us an opportunity to play this piece of music because it was playing in the background.
Yeah,
set this up for us. Tell us the story. It's really terrific.
Okay, so most of the time Lamont has this sound playing in his apartment, and it's an instrument called a tambura, and it's the instrument that provides the drone in Indian music. So when you hear that in the background of Indian music, that's the tambura. And he uses this CD in his performances when he's singing raga against a drone. He doesn't actually use a live tambura. He uses this CD. Mm-hmm. But he also has it playing on loop in his apartment all the time so that as he's, you know, puttering around the house, he sings along with it. So it's Father's Day, and he's calling his dad. And I happened to be there because there was a concert the night before, and I'm just like photocopying scores or something. And he asked me if I want to sit in on the call. And so, first of all, it's so hilarious and charming talking to his parents, and his father, and this I think was maybe 2001 or 2003. I can't remember exactly. This was just a few years before his father passed away.
Yeah.
So first of all, his dad kind of grills me because it's Sunday and he asks if I went to church.
Right.
And I said, well, yeah. And he said, well, did you take Lamont with you? I said, well, no. And he said, well, why not? And I said, well, because he doesn't like to ride the subway, which is true.
Yeah.
But wasn't a true answer to his question.
Right.
And so it's a little bit uncomfortable. And his parents, bless their hearts, are always, were always very gently but firmly, you know, trying to get him to come back to the fold.
Hope springs eternal, of
absolutely,
course.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And anyway, but the discussion gets a little bit tense about Lamont not going to church and not shaving off his beard. That's an important symbol for his father.
Yeah.
So finally, Lamont says, "Hey, Dad, let's sing some cowboy songs." And his dad's kind of taken aback by it. And he said, "Yeah, let's sing the old songs that we used to sing all the time." And so he reaches for the CD player where he has the drone playing. And I thought he was going to turn it down. But instead, he turns it up so his dad can hear it over the phone. And they sing these cowboy songs over the drone. So this is the background for Lamont when he gives a raga concert, when he's singing North Indian music. But instead, over the phone, they start singing Get Along Little Dogies and A Ride in Old Paint and Red River Valley and Bury Me Not on the Lone Prairie, just sort of using the tambura drone as the sort of do of the do-re-mi. And it encapsulated his entire career right there in that moment. Because those, you know, cowboy songs were the first songs that he learned as a two-year-old in Bern, Idaho. And the drone was the same drone that he'd been using the night before for his raga concert.
Jeremy Grimshaw is with us. His book is Draw a Straight Line and Follow It, The Music and Mysticism of Lamont Young. We're going to take another break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the music scholar Jeremy Grimshaw. He's talking about his book, Draw a Straight Line and Follow It, The Music and Mysticism of Lamont Young. Let's talk a little bit about the influences of Lamont Young. I mentioned Brian Eno saying he's the daddy of us all.
Yeah.
Where do I hear him?
Where do you hear Lamont or Brian Eno?
No, both. I mean, where do I hear in what the music of Philip Glass, which, you know, I hear it in soundtracks and those kinds of things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, Lamont Young is in that, at least the influence of that.
Absolutely.
Think?
Well, that's, you know, the sound of minimalism, what we call musical minimalism, is so pervasive that it's sort of, it's you know, blurringly proximate to just about everything anybody encounters. You know, it starts out as this really edgy downtown New York thing in – well, for Lamont, it starts in the late 50s and then for these other composers in the mid-60s. And it's very experimental and on the fringe initially. And eventually, like by the 80s and especially early 90s, it becomes sort of one of the default soundtracks of popular culture. You hear it in, you know, Jim Carrey film soundtracks. And you hear it in IBM commercials, and I mean, it's just sort of all over the place. And I think part of the reason that it becomes so pervasive is because what minimalism – I mean, if you want to define minimalism in music, it's the idea of reducing the number of things going on so that you can encourage the listener to pay more attention to the things that are going on, to sort of zoom in with their ears in a way they wouldn't have otherwise. That's what Lamont means when he says getting inside the sound, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why – I mean, that's why it works so well for like commercials and soundtracks, is because we've sort of been acclimated to this idea of when we hear a repetitive melodic figure or this – or a sort of harmonic stasis or something, that we sort of lean in a little bit and – We're sort of trained by now to sort of pay attention when we hear those kinds of sounds, but they're all over the place. I mean, Brian Eno, for example, he may or may not be a household name.
I bet he is for this crowd.
Yeah, well, I was going to say maybe not in Provo.
Yeah.
You know, and of course he becomes a noted musician in his own right, and he works with David Bowie.
Of course.
And produce Talking Heads and U2 and all of that stuff. And, oh, and Brian Eno also said of the Velvet Underground, I think it was Brian Eno that said that, you know, their first album only sold 1,000 copies, but everybody that bought one started a band. So if you take him at his word with that little anecdote, well, the Velvet Underground, they all studied – well, not all of them, but they some of them were mentored by Lamont Young. They played in his group in the early 60s. And I mean, if I recall correctly, I think Lou Reed like dedicated Metal Machine music to Lamont.
Wow. Would does Lamont Young care about that? I mean, you know, the idea of, you know, he's sort of eschewing the commercial aspect of it. He just doesn't really care about that part, obviously. But does it matter that he's been so influential that people find such meaning in the work that he's done to him?
Yeah, I think the idea of his legacy is actually really important to him. But he's sort of thinking long term. I mean, when he talks about the influence that he hopes to have, I mean, he talks in units of centuries rather than decades, you know. And so I think that's probably the trade-off that he consciously makes, is that he wants to do exactly what he feels inspired to do as a musician. And that's what will ensure his legacy in the long term, even if that means that he doesn't have the audience that he maybe thinks he deserves in the short term.
I want to play another piece of music. As I said, some of them are difficult to play because we're not sure if we have permission to do it. So let's keep, if we should, why don't we keep to the well-tuned piano?
Okay.
And there's this section, this opening chord. First of all, what would it have been like to have attended that performance? Is it like the Ring cycle? I mean, this thing, like, as you 6.5 hours, this thing.
Yeah, well, the final performance in 87 was 6.5. The recording that I think you're playing – no, this is the – yeah, I think you're playing the 1987 recording. So yeah. This would have been a 6.5 hour performance. Now, when you go to a performance of Lamont's music, there's kind of different concert protocols. You go in. There's no applause generally.
Really?
And at one performance I went to, he asked for very little movement. It was kind of hot in there, and people were fanning themselves. And he thought that like the motion of the air in the room was distracting and detrimental to the experience. And it's pretty somber. In this recording, he sits at the piano for several minutes before he plays the first note, and afterwards as well. There's no applause at the end. There's a long pause, and then eventually he leaves. And then
just walks off the stage.
Yeah.
Here's that first opening. Do you have to just let go when you're listening to it? Do you know what I mean? Not be too worried about where it's going. Just sort of let it kind of sweep over you in some way.
You kind of do. I mean, it's kind of cagey, like calling this music like meditative, because that maybe suggests to Westerners like less attention. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're supposed to pay attention to this music. But maybe you could say that you're supposed to pay attention to what, to how it is rather than where it goes. And it does go places, especially the well-tuned piano. It does really have a strong sense of drama and trajectory, but that's stretched over a much longer period of time than most listeners are probably used to. And so in the meantime, you really kind of just have to soak in the nuances of the tuning and just the sounds of the notes themselves. And that's why you leave so much space, especially here at the beginning. He develops these very, very, very slowly, so that by the time he really maxes out this each of these big chords that he develops, you've really sort of spent a lot of time in that world for a while.
Are you hoping more people will come to know Lamont Young through this?
I do. And that's one of the things that eases my conscience a little bit about having a strained relationship with him over the book, is that I really do hope that enough people will be, you know, fascinated by his story, that they'll want to look into his music. And that might encourage him or whoever carries his torch after he's gone, you know, to make it available.
Jeremy Grimshaw. His book is called Draw a Straight Line and Follow It, The Music and Mysticism of Lamont Young. Jeremy Grimshaw, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Doug. My pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.